A minor chord from the balisa floated out of the alcove. Servants began putting plates of food on the table at the Duke's gesture, releasing them. Roast desert hare and sauce cepeda, a plumage syrian, chukka under glass, coffee with melange, a rich cinnamon odor from the spice wafted across the table, a true potoy served with sparkling Caladan wine. Still, the Duke remained standing. As the guests waited, their attention torn between the dishes placed before them and the standing Duke, Leto said,
"In olden times, it was the duty of the host to entertain his guests with his own talents."
His knuckles turned white, so fiercely did he grip his water flagon.
"I cannot sing, but I give you the words of Gurney's song. Consider it another toast, a toast to all who've died bringing us to this station."
An uncomfortable stirring sounded around the table. Jessica lowered her gaze, glanced at the people seated nearest her. There was the round-faced water shipper and his woman, the pale and austere Guild Bank representative. He seemed a whistle-faced scarecrow with his eyes fixed on Leto. The rugged and scar-faced Tuek, his blue-within-blue eyes downcast.
"Review, friends. Troops long past review," the Duke intoned. "All to fate a weight of pains and dollars. Their spirits wear our silver collars. Review, friends. Troops long past review. Each a dot of time, without pretense or guile. With them passes the lure of fortune. Review, friends. Troops long past review. When our time ends on its rictus smile, we'll pass the lure of fortune."
The Duke allowed his voice to trail off on the last line, took a deep drink from his water flagon, slammed it back onto the table. Water slopped over the brim onto the linen. The others drank in embarrassed silence. Again the Duke lifted his water flagon, and this time emptied its remaining half onto the floor, knowing that the others around the table must do the same. Jessica was first to follow his example. There was a frozen moment before the others began emptying their flagons. Jessica saw how Paul, seated near his father, was studying the reactions around him. She found herself also fascinated by what her guests' actions revealed, especially among the women. This was clean, potable water, not something already cast away in a sopping towel. Reluctance to just discard it exposed itself in trembling hands, delayed reactions, nervous laughter, and violent obedience to the necessity. One woman dropped her flagon, looked the other way as her male companion recovered it. Kynes, though, caught her attention most sharply. The planetologist hesitated, then emptied his flagon into a container beneath his jacket. He smiled at Jessica as he caught her watching him, raised the empty flagon to her in a silent toast. He appeared completely unembarrassed by his action. Halleck's music still wafted over the room, but it had come out of its minor key, lilting and lively now as though he were trying to lift the mood.
"Let the dinner commence," the Duke said, and sank into his chair.
"He's angry and uncertain," Jessica thought. "The loss of that factory crawler hit him more deeply than it should have. It must be something more than that loss. He acts like a desperate man."
She lifted her fork, hoping in the motion to hide her own sudden bitterness.
Why not? He is desperate.
Slowly at first, then with increasing animation, the dinner got under way. The stillsuit manufacturer complimented Jessica on her chef and wine.
"We brought both from Caladan," she said.
"Superb," he said, tasting the chukka. "Simply superb. And not a hint of melange in it. One gets so tired of the spice and everything."
The Guild Bank representative looked across at Kynes.
"I understand, Dr. Kynes, that another factory crawler has been lost to a worm." "News travels fast," the Duke said. "Then it's true?" the banker asked, shifting his attention to Leto. "Of course it's true," the Duke snapped. "The blasted carryall disappeared. It shouldn't be possible for anything that big to disappear."
"When the worm came, there was nothing to recover the crawler," Kynes said.
"It should not be possible," the Duke repeated. "No one saw the carryall leave?" the banker asked.
"Spotters customarily keep their eyes on the sand," Kynes said. "They're primarily interested in worm sign. A carryall's complement usually is four men, two pilots and two journeymen attachers. If one, or even two of this crew, were in the pay of the Duke's foes..."
"Ah, I see," the banker said. "And you, as judge of the change, do you challenge this?"
"I shall have to consider my position carefully," Kynes said. and I certainly will not discuss it at table." And he thought, "That pale skeleton of a man, he knows this is the kind of infraction I was instructed to ignore."
The banker smiled, returned his attention to his food. Jessica sat remembering a lecture from her Bene Gesserit school days. The subject had been espionage and counter-espionage. A plump, happy-faced Reverend Mother had been the lecturer, her jolly voice contrasting weirdly with the subject matter.
"A thing to note about any espionage and or counter-espionage school is the similar basic reaction pattern of all its graduates. Any enclosed discipline sets its stamp, its pattern, upon its students. That pattern is susceptible to analysis and prediction. Now, motivational patterns are going to be similar among all espionage agents. That is to say, there will be certain types of motivation that are similar despite differing schools or opposed aims. You will study first how to separate this element for your analysis. In the beginning, through interrogation patterns that betray the inner orientation of the interrogators. Secondly, by close observation of language thought orientation of those under analysis. You will find it fairly simple to determine the root languages of your subjects, of course, both through voice inflection and speech pattern."
Now, sitting at table with her son and her Duke and their guests, hearing that Guild Bank representative, Jessica felt a chill of realization. The man was a Harkonnen agent. He had the Gedi Prime speech pattern, subtly masked, but exposed to her trained awareness as though he had announced himself.
"Does this mean the Guild itself has taken sides against House Atreides?" she asked herself.
The thought shocked her, and she masked her emotion by calling for a new dish, all the while listening for the man to betray his purpose.
"He will shift the conversation next to something seemingly innocent, but with ominous overtones," she told herself. "It's his pattern."
The banker swallowed, took a sip of wine, smiled at something said to him by the woman on his right. He seemed to listen for a moment to a man down the table who was explaining to the Duke that native arecane plants had no thorns.
"I enjoy watching the flights of birds on Arrakis," the banker said, directing his words at Jessica. "All of our birds, of course, are carrion eaters, and many exist without water, having become blood drinkers."
The stillsuit manufacturer's daughter, seated between Paul and his father at the other end of the table, twisted her pretty face into a frown, said,
"Oh, Susu, you say the most disgusting things."
The banker smiled.
"They call me Susu because I'm financial advisor to the Water Peddlers Union."
And as Jessica continued to look at him without comment, he added,
"Because of the water seller's cry, Su, Su, Suk!"
And he imitated the call with such accuracy that many around the table laughed. Jessica heard the boastful tone of voice, but noted most that the young woman had spoken on cue, a set piece. She had produced the excuse for the banker to say what he had said. She glanced at Lingar Boot. The water magnate was scowling, concentrating on his dinner. It came to Jessica that the banker had said,
"I, too, control that ultimate source of power on Arrakis, water."
Paul had marked the falseness in his dinner companion's voice, saw that his mother was following the conversation with Bene Gesserit intensity. On impulse, he decided to play the foil, draw the exchange out. He addressed himself to the banker.
"Do you mean, sir, that these birds are cannibals?"
"That's an odd question, young master," the banker said. "I merely said the birds drink blood. It doesn't have to be the blood of their own kind, does it?"
"It was not an odd question," Paul said,
and Jessica noted the brittle riposte quality of her training exposed in his voice.
"Most educated people know that the worst potential competition for any young organism can come from its own kind."
He deliberately forked a bite of food from his companion's plate, ate it.
"They are eating from the same bowl. They have the same basic requirements."
The banker stiffened, scowled at the Duke.
"Do not make the error of considering my son a child," the Duke said,
and he smiled. Jessica glanced around the table, noted that Boot had brightened, that both Kynes and the smuggler Tuek were grinning.
"It's a rule of ecology," Kynes said, "that the young master appears to understand quite well. The struggle between life elements is the struggle for the free energy of a system. Blood's an efficient energy source."
The banker put down his fork, spoke in an angry voice.
"It's said that the Fremen scum drink the blood of their dead."
Kynes shook his head, spoke in a lecturing tone. "Not the blood, sir, but all of a man's water, ultimately, belongs to his people, to his tribe. It's a necessity when you live near the Great Flat. All water's precious there, and the human body is composed of some 70% water by weight. A dead man, surely, no longer requires that water."
The banker put both hands against the table beside his plate, and Jessica thought he was going to push himself back, leave in a rage. Kynes looked at Jessica.
"Forgive me, my lady, for elaborating on such an ugly subject at table, but you were being told falsehood, and it needed clarifying."
"You've associated so long with Fremen that you've lost all sensibilities," the banker rasped.
Kynes looked at him calmly, studied the pale, trembling face.
"Are you challenging me, sir?"
The banker froze. He swallowed, spoke stiffly.
"Of course not. I'd not so insult our host and hostess."
Jessica heard the fear in the man's voice, saw it in his face, in his breathing, in the pulse of a vein at his temple. The man was terrified of Kynes.
"Our host and hostess are quite capable of deciding for themselves when they've been insulted," Kynes said. "They're brave people who understand defense of honor. We all may attest to their courage by the fact that they are here, now, on Arrakis."
Jessica saw that Leto was enjoying this. Most of the others were not. People all around the table sat poised for flight, hands out of sight under the table. Two notable exceptions were Boot, who was openly smiling at the banker's discomfiture, and the smuggler, Tuwek, who appeared to be watching Kynes for a cue. Jessica saw that Paul was looking at Kynes in admiration.
"Well," Kynes said. "I meant no offense," the banker muttered. "If offense was taken, please accept my apologies."
"Freely given, freely accepted," Kynes said.
He smiled at Jessica, resumed eating as though nothing had happened. Jessica saw that the smuggler, too, had relaxed. She marked this. The man had shown every aspect of an aide ready to leap to Kynes' assistance. There existed an accord of some sort between Kynes and Tuwek. Leto toyed with a fork, looked speculatively at Kynes. The ecologist's manner indicated a change in attitude toward the House of Atreides. Kynes had seemed colder on their trip over the desert. Jessica signaled for another course of food and drink. Servants appeared with long de la pain de carène, red wine and a sauce of mushroom yeast on the side. Slowly, the dinner conversation resumed, but Jessica heard the agitation in it, the brittle quality, saw that the banker ate in sullen silence.
"Kynes would have killed him without hesitating," she thought,
and she realized that there was an offhand attitude toward killing in Kynes' manner. He was a casual killer, and she guessed that this was a Fremen quality. Jessica turned to the stillsuit manufacturer on her left, said,
"I find myself continually amazed by the importance of water on Arrakis."
"Very important," he agreed. "What is this dish? It's delicious."
"Tongues of wild rabbit in a special sauce," she said. "A very old recipe."
"I must have that recipe," the man said.
She nodded.
"I'll see that you get it."
Kynes looked at Jessica, said,
"The newcomer to Arrakis frequently underestimates the importance of water here. You are dealing, you see, with the law of the minimum."
She heard the testing quality in his voice, said,
"Growth is limited by that necessity which is present in the least amount. And naturally, the least favorable condition controls the growth rate."
"It's rare to find members of a great house aware of planetological problems," Kynes said. "Water is the least favorable condition for life on Arrakis. And remember that growth itself can produce unfavorable conditions unless treated with extreme care."
Jessica sensed a hidden message in Kynes' words, but knew she was missing it.